Hi, it's Jeff here, and I'm back in a van again. And here's another blog for you for the end of August 2020. And it's been a very odd time. It's really, really very uncomfortable for some of these people now. That people losing jobs and all over the place. So it's really quite a sad situation going on. Anyway, I'm going to give a small book review of a book I've recently read. And it is quite a thought-provoking book, actually, and I really recommend this book. Because I think if you do come to the sort of MGTOW philosophy, I could almost guarantee that you have been through some sort of trial and difficulties with females. And so I think it's very easy to get wrapped up with all this talk about females, etc. And if you are going your own way, I think it's doubly important for people to have a book like this. And it's called The Mastering of Your Mind. And it's by Robert Zentes, I think that is. It's Zentes. And I'll leave a link for anybody who's interested on Amazon for this book. At the moment, it is £7 to buy. And so I think it's well worth spending the £7. And when I first started reading it, I thought, oh my God, this is ridiculous. It's talking about love and how blue pill that is, this aspect of feeling love and all this sort of thing. And it does say in the text that, to read the book, it is quite challenging because it challenges your own views of every, everything. And the this concept of in the end, it's the end of the towards the end of the book, it sort of says you have to feel love, or you can make yourself quite ill, and it brings on illness. And so, if you're a MGTOW, you may have decided that you don't want to love a woman. So, it can, I think, could be quite a difficult time and a difficult journey. So I think what I would say is that I read the book and it challenged me, and it challenges your view of everything in a way. It challenges your view of yourself, because it actually asks very uncomfortable questions about yourself, and why do you feel the things that you feel, and the emotions that you feel are can be linked back to events in childhood. And so that's quite an incredible thought, that all of the emotions that we feel, and bad emotions and thoughts about people, it comes from our learning as we are from a baby onwards. We have these experiences, and A lot of us have negative experiences, I think, from the baby stage onwards. And those experiences really colour our whole view of the world. And so it's ask these difficult questions to go back into your own past and identify these very difficult events in your past that are actually making you feel things towards people and, judgment of people, a negative judgment and negative emotions, can easily sort of be tracked back to events in childhood. Towards the end of the book, as I say, it sort of says to, feel love. And I think not a lot of people talk about love for yourself, and forget about loving women, loving other, people at the moment. Let's just talk about ourselves. Who can honestly say, listening to this, that they love themselves? And, it's quite a difficult exercise to feel love towards yourself. It's never taught, it's never spoken about. To actually turn that love that you want to put outwardly to somebody, to actually turn that love into your towards your own self and forgive the events and the people in the past of difficult events that have happened to you. And we all have a myriad of things that have happened to us over our lives, and multifaceted levels of difficult, emotions that get built up. And that in the book it says to go back into the past and forgive the people who did any wrong towards you, and just to move into a place of forgiveness and lack of judgment as well, to sort of not judge people and to love yourself. And I think it takes a lot of practice. If you haven't ever felt love towards yourself, it takes, well, I don't know, it could take years. It could take a lot of practice to actually feel love for your own self. And the thing about this is, if you feel love for yourself, then that will show in your body language and your own mood. That will sort of show, and people will pick that up, that self-love will sort of shine out from you, and people will notice this. So, when you're walking along, if you're not judging people, and because everybody has a myriad of hurts in their upbringing, so if you can walk and feel love for yourself and forgiveness for other people, and not to judge other people, it really does open up quite a level of self-happiness, which will actually show, and people will be perhaps more open to you. And as I say, it takes a lot of practice, but this book does help along the way. I think perhaps, I think when we grow up, we are taught to look for love from an outside source. which of course is the ideal, I suppose, but you know, I would say on the whole it's fraught with sort of difficulties actually, because people don't behave in the way that you expect them to behave. So you know, if you haven't got that self-love, you could easily become very, very sort of despondent, and I think that is a problem with MGTOW, that you could become very despondent and isolated if you haven't built up this your own sort of you know, force field, I suppose you could call it, of self-love. So you know, it sounds very blue pill all this, I know, but I think it's helped me very much reading this book, and you know, I do feel like I'm moving forward in some small way, and so I do really recommend this book. I'll leave the link in the notes area or wherever it is. So I hope you enjoyed this one. It's quite a short, quick one, and I hope this helps you. I'll sign off for now. Bye for now. Hi, it's Jeff here, and in this blog I'm going to read from the excellent book by Esther Villa, and it's called The Manipulated Male, or Manipulated Male, sorry, not The Manipulated Male. Okay, so here we go. This book is dedicated to all those whom it does not mention, to the few men who refuse to be manipulated, to the few women who are not venal, and all those fortunate enough to have lost their market value because they are either too old, too ugly, or too ill. That's the damning introduction. Okay. Authors, sorry, that's a preface. This is the author's introduction. Over 35 years have passed since the first publication of my book, The Manipulated Man, a pamphlet written in great anger against the women's movement worldwide, monopoly of opinion. The determination which those women portrayed us as victims of men not only seemed humiliating, but also unrealistic. If someone should want to change the destiny of our sex, a wish I had then, as I have today, then that someone should attempt to do so with more honesty, and possibly also with a little humour. I would like to take the opportunity presented by the reissue of my book to answer two questions which I am asked again and again in this context. People often ask me if I would write this book again. Well, I find it right and proper to have done so. But seen from today's perspective, my courage in those days may only be attributable to a lack of imagination. Despite all I wrote, I could not really imagine the power I was up against. It seemed that one is only allowed to criticise women on the quiet, especially as a woman, and could only expect agreement behind closed doors. As we women have, thanks to our relatively stress-free life, a higher life expectancy than men. That sort of hits home, doesn't it? and consequently make up the majority of voters in the Western industrial nations. No politician could afford to offend us. The media is not interested in discussing the issues involved either. Their products are financed through the advertising of consumer goods. And should we women decide to stop reading a certain newspaper or magazine as its editorial policy displeases us, then the advertisements targeted at us would also disappear. After all, it is well established that women make the majority of purchasing decisions. However, I had also underestimated men's fear of re-evaluating their position. Yet the more sovereignty they are losing in their professional lives, the more automatic their work, the more controlled by computers they become, the more that increasing unemployment forces them to adopt obsequious behaviour towards customers and superiors, then the more they have to be afraid of a recognition of their predicament, and the more essential it becomes to maintain their illusion that it is not they who are the slaves, but on whose behalf they subject themselves to such an existence. And absurd as it may sound, today's men need feminists much more than their wives do. Feminists are the last ones who still describe men the way they like to see themselves, as egocentric, power-obsessed, ruthless, and without inhibitions when it comes to satisfying their animalistic instincts. Well, that's damning. Damning. Therefore, the most aggressive women's libbers find themselves in the strange predicament of doing more to maintain the status quo than anyone else, without their arrogant accusations, the macho man would no longer exist, except perhaps in the movies. If the press didn't stylize men as rapacious wolves, the actual sacrificial lambs of the men's society, men themselves would no longer flock to the factories so obediently. So I hadn't imagined broadly enough the isolation I would find myself in after writing this book, nor had I envisaged the consequences which it would have for my subsequent writing and even for my private life. Violent threats not ceased to this date. A woman who defended the arch enemy, who didn't equate domestic life with solitary confinement, and who described the company of young children as a pleasure, not a burden, necessarily had to become a misogynist, even a reactionary and fascist in the eyes of the public. Had not Karl Marx determined once and for all that an industrial society, it is us, the women, who are the most oppressed? It goes without saying, doesn't it, that someone who did not want to take part in the canonization of her own sex is also opposed to equal wages and equal opportunities. In other words, if I had known then what I know today, I probably wouldn't have written this book. And that is precisely the reason why I'm so glad to have written it. I would like to take this opportunity to thank the handful of people have stood up for me and my work. Typically, most of them were women. The second question I am often asked is about topicality of the opinions I expressed then. To what extent is what I described over 35 years ago still relevant to the new woman and the new man? Here's a list of issues which I recognised in the original book to be men's most significant disadvantages compared to women. Number one, men are conscripted, women are not. Men are sent to fight in wars, women are not. Men retire later than women, even though due to their lower life expectancy, they should have the right to retire earlier. Men have almost no influence over their reproduction. For males, there is neither a pill nor abortion, but can only get the children women want them to have. Number five. Men support women. Women never, or only temporarily, support men. Number six. Men work all their lives. Women work only temporarily or not at all. Seven. Even though men work all their lives and women work only temporarily or not at all, on average, men are poorer than women. Eight. Men only borrow their children. Women can keep them, as men work all their lives and women do not. Men are automatically robbed of their children in cases of separation, with the reasoning that they have to work. As one can see, if anything, the female position of power has only consolidated. Today in the military is also open to women in many countries, but without conscription for all. Many achieve for themselves the right to practice their job for the same number of years as their male colleagues. However, the retirement age was not increased for all of us. Actually, that has changed. The retirement is the same now, much to women's disgust. And now, as before, it does not occur to the underprivileged to fight against this grotesque state of affairs. Only as far as the sixth point is concerned, has there been a significant change in the more entertaining spheres of work. There are more and more women who happily and willingly work and still keep their jobs despite having their children. They nevertheless desire. But only a few of these women were prepared to offer a life of comfort, not only to their children, but also to the children's fathers, supported by their often substantial salaries. And fewer would further be prepared, in case of a separation, to give up their home and offspring and support the next admirer with what is left of her income. Also, men not like it. Emancipation may be fine, but to be kept by a woman is still not acceptable. Housekeeping and raising children is not worthy of a real man. Sadly, women's manipulation of men is a topical today, as it was back then. But so are the measures which could be used to end it, to the benefit of both sexes. In the meantime, however, there are already a few feminists who are talking about men as human beings. So the continuation of the discussion may not have to be conducted quite so loudly. That's the introduction. And the first chapter, The Slave's Happiness. The lemon-coloured MG skids across the road and the woman driver brings it to some what uncertain halt. She gets out and finds her left front tyre flat. Without wasting a moment, she prepares to fix it. She looks towards the passing cars as if expecting someone, recognising the standard international sign of women in distress. Weak female let down by male technology. A station wagon draws up. The driver sees what is wrong at a glance and says comfortingly, "Don't worry, we'll fix that in a jiffy." To prove his determination, he asks her for her jack. He does not ask if she is capable of changing the tyre herself, because he knows she's about 30, smartly dressed and made up, that she is not. Since she cannot find a Jack, he fetches his own, together with his other tools. 5 minutes later, the job is done, and the punctured tire properly stowed. His hands are covered with grease. She offers him an embroidered handkerchief, which he politely refuses. He has a rag for such occasions in his toolbox. The woman thanks him profusely, apologising for her typically feminine helplessness. She might have been there till dusk, she says, had he not stopped. He makes no reply and she gets back into the car, gallantly shuts the door for her. Through the wound-down window, he advises her to have her tyre patched at once, and she promises to get her garage man to see to it the very evening. She then drives off. As the man collects his tools, he goes back to his own car. He wishes he could wash his hands. His shoes, he had been standing in the mud while changing the tyre, are not as clean as they should be. He's a salesman. What is more, he will have to hurry to keep his next appointment. As he starts the engine, he thinks, women, one more stupid than the next. He wonders what she would have done if he had not been there to help. He puts the foot on the accelerator and drives off faster than usual. There is the delay to make up. After a while, he starts to hum him to himself. Anyway, he is happy. Almost any man would behave in the same manner, and so most women, without thinking, simply because men are men, and women are so different from them. A woman will make use of a man wherever there is the opportunity. What else could a woman have done when her car broke down? She has been taught to get a man to help. Thanks to his knowledge, he was able to change the tyre quickly and at no cost to herself. True, he ruined his clothes, put his business in jeopardy, and endangered his own life by driving too fast. Afterwards, had he found something else wrong with her car, however, he would have repaired that also. That is what his knowledge of cars is for. Why should a woman learn to change a flat tyre when the opposite sex, half the world's population, is able to and willing to do it for her? Women let men work for them, think for them, and take on their responsibilities. In fact, they exploit them. Yet men are strong, intelligent, and imaginative, while women are weak, unimaginative, and stupid. Why isn't it men? Oh, excuse me, who exploit women? Could it be that strength, intelligence and imagination are not prerequisites for power, but mere qualifications for slavery? Could it be that the world is not being ruled by experts, but by beings who are not fit for anything else, by women? And if this is so, how do women manage it to their victims do not feel themselves cheated and humiliated, but rather believe to be themselves what they are, least of all, masters of the universe? How do women manage to instill in men this sense of pride and superiority that inspires them to ever greater achievements? Why are women never unmasked? And so, yes, that's the first section of the book. And, well, that describes the White Knight complex and, you know, the thing we all fall into as we grow up. We fall into this White Knight complex when we see the feeble female ask for help and we... feel we must leap to her aid and, feel sorry for her. And it's interesting reading that section where it says that the salesman had to drive off much faster, risking his own life. And he felt happy about his encounter with the women. And I think men have so little attention from women that any sort of contact like that, traditionally, you would be pleased to have a sort of a woman to actually pay you attention at all. Even if it meant getting your hands greasy and dirty, just so that you could help her to actually get some attention. So I think right from the off, you're on a losing streak, because being men, and really being fairly ignored by women altogether. And I talked about this earlier in another blog, that when you grow up, you don't have any attention from girls or women. So you, when you do get some, you think, you really do think your boat has come in, as Rollo Tomasi wrote in his, I think it was, I think one of his blogs, or maybe in his book, The Rational Male. So, it's sort of, you're sort of taught to be dependent on some sort of validation from the female as sort of excitement. And so that's the first section. And I'll read the next section in the next blog, to try and keep it short. And my voice is probably boring the hell out of you as well, so I'm going to sign off there. And the next section I will read in the next blog. Take care and speak to you soon. Hello, it's Jeff again with another reading from Esther Vilar's excellent book. This is chapter, well, I don't think this is chapter two, but I'm just calling it episode two. This next section is titled, What is Man? A man is a human being who works by working, who works, sorry, by working, he supports himself, his wife, and his wife's children. Notice that, she says, his wife's children. A woman, on the other hand, is a human being who does not work, or at least only temporarily. Most of her life, she supports neither herself nor her children, let alone her husband. Any qualities in a man that a woman finds useful, she calls masculine. That's shocking, isn't it? All others are of no use to her, or anyone else for that matter, she chooses to call effeminate. A man's appearance has to be masculine if he wants to have success with women. And that means it will have to be geared to his one and only raison d'être, work. His appearance must conform to each and every task put to him, and he must always be able to fulfill it. Except at night, when the majority of men wear striped pyjamas, and at most two pairs of pockets. Men wear a kind of uniform made of durable, stain-resistant material in brown, blue, or grey. These uniforms or suits have up to 10 pockets in which men carry instruments and tools indispensable for their work. Since a woman does not work, her night or day clothes rarely have pockets. For social events, men are permitted to wear black, a colour that shows marks and stains, since on those occasions men are less likely to dirty themselves. Moreover, the bright colours worn by women show to advantage against it. The occasional red or green evening jackets worn by men are acceptable, since by contrast, all the real men present seem to be much more masculine. The rest of a man's appearance is also adapted to this situation. His hairstyle requires only 15 minutes at the barber every 2 or 3 weeks. Curls, waves, and tents are not encouraged, as they might hinder his work. Men often work in the open air or spend a considerable amount of time in it. Hence, complicated styles would be of a nuisance. Furthermore, it is improbable that such styles would make a hit with women, since unlike men, they never judge the opposite sex from an aesthetic point of view. So most men, after one or two attempts at individuality, realise that women are indifferent to their efforts and revert to a standard style, short or long. The same is true of beards. Only oversensitive men, usually ones with intellectual pretensions, who want to appear mentally tough by letting their facial hair grow indiscriminately, wear a full beard for any length of time. It will be tolerated by women, however, for a beard is an important indication of a man's character, and therefore of the way in which he might be most easily exploited. It's absolutely damning. Shocking, isn't it? His field of work will usually be that of a neurotic intellectual. Generally, a man uses an electric razor for about 3 minutes every morning to keep his beard in check, for his skin, soap and water are considered good enough. All that is required is cleanliness and an absence of makeup so that everyone can see what he is like. As for his fingernails, they should be short as possible for work. Apart from a wedding ring, worn to show that he is being used by a particular woman for a particular purpose. Ouch, that hurts. A proper man wears no ornaments. His clumsy functional watch, worn on the wrist, is hardly decorative, heavy and designed, waterproof, shock resistant, and showing the correct date, and it cannot possibly be called an ornament. Usually it was given to him by the woman for whom he works. Shirts, underwear, and socks for real men are so standardized that their only difference is one of size. They can be bought in any shop without difficulty or loss of time. Only as far as ties are concerned is there any degree of freedom, and then a man is usually so unused to choosing that he lets the woman buy them for him. Anyone visiting Earth from another planet would think each man's goal to work as much like the next as possible. Yet to fulfill a woman's purposes, masculinity and male usefulness vary a considerable degree. Necessarily, because women, who hardly ever work, need men for everything. There are men who carefully manoeuvre a large limousine out of the garage at 8 o'clock every morning. Others leave an hour earlier, travelling in the middle-class sedan. Others leave when it is not yet light, wearing overalls, and carry lunchboxes to catch buses, subways, or trains to factories or building sites. By a trick of fate, it is always the latter, the poorest, who are exploited by the least attractive women. For unlike women, who have an eye for money, men notice only women's external appearance. Therefore, the more desirable women in their own class are always being snatched away from under their noses by men who happen to earn more. No matter what a particular man does or how he spends his day, he has one thing in common with all other men. He spends it in a degrading manner. that I highlighted that, and I think that most men would agree. And he himself does not gain by it. It is not his own livelihood that matters. He would have to struggle far less for that, MGTOW, since luxuries do not mean anything to him anyway. It is, in fact, that he does it for others that makes him so tremendously proud. He will undoubtedly have a photograph of his wife and children on his desk and will miss no opportunity to hand it round. No matter what a man's job may be, bookkeeper, doctor, bus driver or managing director, every moment of his life will be spent as a cog in a huge, pitiless system. A system designed to exploit him to the utmost, to his dying day. Ow, that hurts. It may be interesting to add up figures and make them tally, but surely not year in, year out. How exciting must it be to drive a bus through a busy town, but always the same route, the same time, the same town, day after day, year after year. What a magnificent feeling of power to know that countless workers obey one's command. But how would one feel if one suddenly realised one was their prisoner, not their master? We have long ceased to play the games of childhood. As children, we became bored quickly and changed from one game to another. A man is like a child who is condemned to play the same game for the rest of his life. The reason is obvious. As soon as he discovered to have a gift for one thing, he's made to specialise. Then, because he can earn more money in that field than another, he's forced to do it forever. If he was good at maths at school, if he had a head for figures, he will be sentenced to a lifetime of figure work as bookkeeper, mathematician, or computer operator, for there lies the maximum work potential. Therefore, he will add up figures, press buttons, and add more figures, but he will never be able to say, I'm bored, I want to do something else, exclamation mark. The woman who is exploiting him will never permit him to look for something else. And I agree with that wholeheartedly. I have a brother who desperately wanted to change his career completely, and of course he wasn't allowed to by his wife. It was out of the question. Driven by this woman, he may engage in a desperate struggle against competitors to improve his position and perhaps even become head clerk or managing director of a bank. But isn't the price he is paying for his improved salary rather too high? Question mark. And that, I think, alludes to the amount of stress that men take on in their career as they get more senior. A man who changes his way of life, or rather his profession, for life and profession are synonymous to him. He is considered unreliable. If he does it more than once, he becomes a social outcast and remains alone. The fear of being rejected by society must be considerable. And I think that is very, very interesting, the rejected by society. And that, I think, is real, that rejection. Why else will a doctor, who as a child liked to observe tadpoles in a jam jar, spend his life opening up nauseating growths, examining the pronouncing on human excretions? Why else does he busy himself night and day with people of such repulsiveness that anyone else is driven away? Does a pianist who, as a child, liked to tinkle on the piano really enjoy playing the same Chopin Nocturne over and over again all his life. Why else does a politician who as a schoolboy discovered the techniques of manipulating people successfully continue as an adult, mouthing words and phrases as a minor government functionary? Does he actually enjoy contorting his face and playing the fool and listening to idiotic chatter of other politicians? Surely he must have once have dreamt of different kind of life. Even if he became president of the United States, wouldn't the price be too high? No one can hardly assume men do all this for pleasure and without feeling a desire for change. They do it because they have been manipulated into doing it. Their whole life is nothing but a series of conditioned reflexes, a series of animal acts. A man who is no longer able to perform these acts, whose earning capacity is lessened, is considered a failure. He stands to lose everything: wife, family, home, his whole purpose in life, all the things, in fact, which give him security. Of course, one might say that a man who has lost his capacity for earning money is automatically freed from his burden and should be glad about this happy ending. But freedom is the last thing he wants. He functions, as we shall see, according to the principle of pleasure in non-freedom. To be sentenced to a lifelong freedom is a worse fate than a lifelong slavery. To put it another way, a man is always searching for someone or something to enslave him, for only as a slave does he feel secure, and as a rule, his choice falls on a woman. Who or what in this creature who is responsible for his lonely existence? And moreover, exploits him in such a way that he only feels safe as her slave and her slave alone. Well, I think that's the first, that's that section finished. And I just want to quickly chat about that. I think I very much felt like that, and I know exactly how that feels as. When I lost my job, as I might have mentioned, I became disabled by deafness. And I remember feeling very, very down. And, I felt very, very, very guilty about it all. Not, not working and, not do anything. And actually, my whole family sort of made me feel guilty and they sort of look at me. In a bad way. It's very difficult to bear that if you're in a family and you lose your job and the respect seems to go out the window. But thankfully, I found Magtow, and thankfully, I've listened to hundreds and hundreds of hours of Magtow content, and reading this book, of course, has been instrumental in me. Finding my own confidence and my own, voice. So I don't feel guilty anymore. And yeah, I still feel a little bit like I should be doing something with my brain, that I should be engaging my brain. And the interesting thing is my sister hasn't worked all her life. And she sort of busies herself with family bits and bobs, but she's never, I don't think she's ever felt any guilt at all. I mean, she's never felt like her brain's going, to mashed potato or something, So, I wonder if the conditioning goes so deep in men that they feel like they have to be doing something, that they have to be busy. Otherwise, they're gonna, fall down dead or something. It's an interesting thought. Anyway, that's the end of this blog, and I'll read the next section, which is focusing on the woman. Speak to you in the next episode. Bye for now.